Tathagata's true meaning. Good morning. I can honestly say it's great to be here. Number of people I've talked to during this session have said, gee, I'm having a blast. And for the most part, that's been my experience here. Realizing, of course, that the blast I've been having is due to the incredible effort that a lot of people have put in to making this happen. Eisho Hoshi organizing it, managing it, Arshuso doing task after task after task with his inimitable good cheer and whimsy, which we'll be getting a lot more of during the next 3 months, so stay tuned. It's a joy to have him fulfilling that role. And then, of course, all the students, senior and otherwise, who know their jobs so well that things just seem to flow along seamlessly. So, hey, we managed a 90, 95-person session. We, the Village Zendo, we did this, and it worked, and it was a blast. So, deep gratitude to all of you, and also to Roshi, because when something like this happens, all of a sudden her mind is revealed. I piddle around Tuesday nights at the Zendo, 8 people show up, that's Roshi's mind too. That wouldn't have been happening without her, but when something like this happens, we can really see what those 30-odd years of intense practice have produced for all of us. Gassho Roshi. So, I don't really have much to say, but as you know, that's never stopped me in the past. The Dharma talks have been uniformly excellent, in my opinion. And, one thing that each in their different ways they've made very clear to me is that the Diamond Sutra is not at all this rarefied, abstract, impossible to comprehend document. It's expressed a little differently than we're used to, but each and every one of the speakers has made it clear that far from being abstract and rarefied, the Diamond Sutra couldn't be more concrete and immediate and relevant to our lives right here and right now. So basically, I'm not going to say anything new. I'm just going to footnote and reemphasize the points that the previous speakers made. So if you can remember back to day one, Dharma Talk one, Roshi focused on one of the major, major things that the sutra is about is how the bodhisattva should arrange his mind. What should his mind be like? And that is a great question because, someone who says, I'm here to save all sentient beings, is a very tedious and egocentric person and someone you certainly wouldn't invite to your dinner party. So if it's not that, if it's not me, I'm Ryotan, I'm here to save you, If it's not that, what is it? What is the mind of the Bodhisattva like? And the Buddha's answer was, all Bodhisattvas should develop a mind that clings to nothing whatsoever, or depending on no thing, right there realize the mind. And as it happens, this is very relevant to us in Zen, because as Roshi pointed out, these were the words that the sixth ancestor heard being recited and had his sudden enlightenment, even though he was Joe Blow from nowhere, no previous meditation experience, just hauling wood from house to house. So, what is the Bodhisattva's mind? What is the Bodhisattva's expression? What does it look like when the mind is realized abiding nowhere, depending on nothing? And there's a koan, I think, that brings this out really nicely. It has to do with one of our Chinese founding ancestors, Shaoshan. And a monk came to Shaoshan and asked, how is it when the morning clothes are not worn? Okay, now, just to explain what that question is about, the monk is comparing the process of trying to realize the true self, you know, to going to a funeral, to being in mourning, you know, kind of like Sesshin. You keep your eyes down, you know, you wear black, all of that. You strip everything, bare, minimum, you know. We're deep in the heart of winter here. It's the shortest day of the year. And finally, if all goes well, you die. And there's no need to wear the mourning clothes anymore. It's happened. And so the monk is asking, when you reach Anuttarak Samyak Sambodhi, when you die the great death, how is it when you're not wearing the mourning clothes anymore? And Shaoshan said, today, Shaoshan's filial duty is fulfilled. In other words, when you realize the mind that abides nowhere, you repay your filial duty to all the ancestors, from Shakyamuni to Taizan Maizumi Roshi to Enkyo Roshi. You repay your filial duty right in that moment when you realize who you really are. Then the monk says, and now we get into Bodhisattva land, the monk said, okay, how about after the fulfillment of filial duty? I mean, what next? You've realized the supreme awakening. How about after? And Shaoshan said, Shaoshan likes to get falling down drunk. Now, we can get a good laugh out of his answer, but he's pointing directly at the nature of this Bodhisattva mind that abides nowhere. You think of a drunken fellow, hey, hey, hey. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know the phrase, blind drunk. The Bodhisattva has died the great death. He's totally blind. He just has cleared himself out, and what he does is what he does, all right? And he's not, I'm here to save you. He's He's a jolly fellow. He's filled with the joy of the Dharma. So think of bodhisattvas, one from our culture, Santa Claus. Ho, ho, ho! A similar figure to the realized bodhisattva at the end of the 10 Oxford herding pictures, Hote, who after years and years of practice ends up being this jolly, dirty old fellow who's come down from the mountains into the marketplace, all dusty and dirty and laughing, pack on his back, giving gifts to children. And whenever anyone asks him a question about the Dharma, he laughs and says, "Give me one penny." Nothing pretentious. Or think about the poet that Joshin Sensei mentioned, Nasruddin. If you remember, he falls down the stairs with a great clatter, and his wife goes, "What's going on?" And he says, "My clothes fell down the stairs." "Well, then why so much noise?" "Well, I was in them." And Joshin Sensei compared this to, normally we're in the clothes of our conditioning. We carry around all these socially conditioned garments. And, in the process of, like here, we start stripping them away. And so when you're in that squeaky clean kind of process, if you're going to take a nice long shower, there's no need to be wearing those, junky old clothes. You can just stand under the shower naked and free and totally clean. And, you're not doing jack. Sooner or later, you got to get out of that pure, clean shower of the Dharma, put on those stinky old clothes that you've been carrying around with you all the life, and like the drunken man, So, is there anything rarefied about this? Abstract? I don't think so. And then next we heard from Shinryu about Diamond Chu. And if you'll remember, he was the great scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and an old woman by the side of the road selling rice cakes said, "Well, I'll sell you a rice cake if you can answer a question about the Diamond Sutra." And Chu thought it was a lock. And she said, "Well, the Diamond Sutra says past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. With which mind will you eat my rice cake?" Okay, so this ungraspable thing is, again, it's another scary, seemingly abstract thing. But if you think about it, it's really not. And Dogen Zenji points this out to us very well. And Dogen really, he's a contrarian. He likes to go against the received wisdom. And he says, "As I reflect on this story, it is clear that Daishan had not clarified the matter." But then he goes on to say, "Although the old woman shut him up, we cannot say whether she was a person of true understanding. It is possible that she heard of ungraspable mind and asked this question, thinking that mind is ineffable." So Dogen is making some distinction here between ungraspable and ineffable. And it might be helpful just to look at those two words. So I took a look in the Oxford Dictionary, And the dictionary defines ungraspable as impossible to comprehend or understand. And Dogen says, absolutely, ungraspable. When asked about past mind, say ungraspable. When asked about present mind, say ungraspable. When asked about the future mind, say ungraspable. It means that there is no mind that is called ungraspable, but it is described as ungraspable for the time being. He says, this ungraspable is the mind. There is also the ungraspableness of, with no place to abide, the mind emerges. So Dogen is totally down with this idea of ungraspable, can't be known through the conscious intellect. But he is not at all okay with ineffable. Ineffable, according to the dictionary, means too great or extreme to be described in words. And Dogen says, I can describe it in words. The Buddha mind is walls, tiles, and pebbles. Buddhas in the past, present, and future realize it as ungraspable. Walls, tiles, and pebbles are just Buddha mind. So, in other words, this ungraspable, incomprehensible Dharma, yes, it is ungraspable, incomprehensible, but it's not weird. It's just in the things we see every day. Walls, tiles, pebbles, not ineffable, you can name it, you know. Joe, John, Tokyo, Joshin, Roshi. There's nothing ineffable about it. Walt Whitman made a similar point as Dogen when he says, far from being ungraspable, he says, I hear and behold God in every object, yet understand God not in the least. I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name, and I leave them where they are, for I know that wheresoe'er I go, others will punctually come forever and ever. So it looks like this grand, ungraspable Dharma is a dime a dozen, readily available at every moment of our lives, waking or sleeping. Nothing remote, nothing weird. Nothing far away here. The third area where we find the Diamond Sutra mentioned directly in the Zen text that we customarily read here at the Village Zendo, it wasn't directly mentioned by the previous speakers, but it was certainly very implicitly alluded to, and that is the koan in the Book of Serenity, where it says, the diamond cutter scripture says, if someone is reviled by others, this person has done wicked acts in previous ages and should fall into evil ways. But because of the scorn and revilement of people in the present age, the wicked deeds of past ages are dissolved. And this sounds, a little weird, you might have stopped when you came across it in your reading, if people are dissing you in this life, it means that you committed acts in the past life, but because they're dissing you, that bad karma from the past is dissolved. And I'm sure the literal reading is, widely believed by Buddhists all over the world. But in our tradition, there's a different take on it. And that take was alluded to by both Joshin Hoshi and Miyoko Sensei when they talked about using this bright, clear awareness, this diamond mind to look at. Well, in the case of Eisho Hoshi, to allow herself to experience the pain in her back and to let it come into that bright, clear awareness. In the case of Miyoko Sensei, the self-recrimination over her frustration that she's having with her career and allowing those feelings to come up into that bright space and to be with them just as they are in that moment. And that's exactly what the sixth ancestor was commenting on when he talked about this passage. In his commentary, the sixth ancestor noted that there are two ways to interpret this passage in the Diamond Sutra. And he called one of the ways an inner way, and the other one is an outward-directed way. And so Miyoko and Eisho were talking about what the sixth ancestor calls the inner-directed way, the way of contemplation. He says, the inner way is where the clear mind of the present moment, quote, scorns, or I like to say kids, scorns the deluded mind of the previous moment just by noticing it, thereby transferring it from delusion to the unfolding of the Buddha mind itself. So I think we've all had this experience in our meditation where suddenly we become aware that the same story, the same tape has been playing over and over and over again, and we don't necessarily scorn it, but at some point we just go, come on, get off it. This is getting really, really old. And as soon as that shift happens, the karmic energy of that particular dharma begins to subside, and it can reveal itself to be what it's been all along, as simply another manifestation of the incomparable Buddha mind. But then the sixth answer Sensor goes on to say that there's a different, another way. There's an outer way. So the first way is this kind of inward-directed contemplation. But he says the outer way of upholding the sutra is not to separate from others by producing the idea of a separate self. He says, because you yourself uphold the scripture, you do not produce images such as self and others, and always practice respect and honor without regard to enemy or friend. And so when the bright, clear awareness is outer-directed, we perceive the equality of all dharmas. And so whether we're being scorned and reviled or praised to the skies or usually just ignored, again, the karmic energy, the storyline, is not generated, and we embody the scripture outwardly through our kindness, through our generosity, through embodying the precepts. And here is the most important point of all. The sixth ancestor says that the inner way of contemplation and the outer way of embodying the spirit of the precepts, the spirit of equality, the spirit of the mind that does not abide anywhere, they're not two. Inner and outer are not two. There is no inner and outer fundamentally. And so it seems, you know, when we're sitting here very seriously on our cushion, working and working and working on our zazen, that seems quite different than when we're on the subway and someone steps on our foot and... In both cases, we have the choice to embody the non-dual dharma, to embody non-separation, and to take that karma and allow it to subside into the radiant light of the Buddha way, which it has been all along. We're just revealing it to be what it always has been, but which we were unable to see because of our egocentric notions about how the world should work and how people should be and how we're supposed to feel and what we deserve or don't deserve. These notions are legion, and all of them are radiant expressions of the Buddha mind, if only we open ourselves to perceive them. And so, far from being abstract, the Diamond Sutra is about being this drunken fool who doesn't know what he's doing or she's doing, but who embodies the spirit of the precepts, you know, not going through a checklist. Have I done well on precept 3, precept 5? Well, sometimes it's important to do that. Sometimes it's okay. But more important, it's important not to obey the precepts, but to be the precepts, to be the mind that abides nowhere, to fall drunkenly down the stairs of our lives, and in the process somehow, we don't know what it happens, that seems to be beneficial, not only to ourselves, but to everyone we come in contact with. Ho, 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 ho. Walt Whitman summarized what it is to embody this spirit beautifully in his preface to Leaves of Grass, and I will leave you with that thought. He says, "This is what you shall do. Love the earth and sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or to any man or number of men. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons, and with the young, and with mothers and families. Read these leaves in the open air every season of every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss whatever insults your soul. And so far we have lots of do's and don'ts, but then he tells us what to do with them, to embody them. He says, if you do this, your very flesh shall be a great poem and have the richest fluency, not only in its words, but in the silent lines of its lips and face and between the lashes of your eyes and in every motion and joint of your body.